this special meeting of Port of Port Townsend on Wednesday, May 28th, 3 o'clock, meeting to order.
Just a little preamble, commissioners.
According to this, and this is since this is a regular meeting, we have the Pledge of Allegiance.
I threw it in there.
Let's do it then.
I pledge allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Shane is here from today from Coast and Harbor. He's been up and inspected the breakwater at Point Hudson, has prepared a fairly in-depth briefing for us, and invited Tyke here as well. And I'd like him to take us through it. Feel free to ask questions at any time. There's a lot of detail in this. He really did a thorough inspection. And then we probably need to talk about the way ahead. Keep in mind, you know, we need to get to a point with engineer drawings to where we can start the permitting process. And it's going to take at least a year with the Corps and Fish and Wildlife and all the other agencies. So we really would like to be in permitting this December. So we'll need to make a decision fairly soon as to what course of action we want, that sort of thing. And then we can talk afterwards about some thoughts the staff has on how to proceed and using some of the authority the port districts have in the way we approach these sorts of projects. So with that, Shane, tell us.
So I've got a PowerPoint set up here, so folks out here, I don't know if you might want to move your PowerPoint so you can see. So yeah, my name is Shane Phillips with Coast and Harbor Engineering, and our firm specializes in coastal engineering and marine structures type work. So we've done a lot of smaller boating facility, recreational marina type projects around Puget Sound. Recent projects that we've been involved with on private site was Hat Island, with reconstruction of their and expansion of their marina and reconstruction of their breakwaters, as well as work at Port of Anacortes near the Capistani Marina at the old Scott site. There's new breakwaters and restoration of the old mill site there. So, you know, that kind of gives context of my company and the kinds of work that we've done. So, very similar to your facility at Point Hudson. And so, yeah, as Larry mentioned, our scope in this phase was to do a feasibility condition assessment, look at some alternatives, and come up with an idea of some preferred concepts for the rehabilitation or replacement of these breakwaters and order of magnitude idea of cost so that you folks can make some decisions on what direction you want to go. So first, outline here, a couple different things I want to go through. The first thing is the history. I think it's important that everybody's on the same page with respect to the history of the structure. That helps us understand where we're at today, and that helps in making decisions on which direction to go. And then get a little more into what our assessment of the condition of the structures were, some analysis work we did, and options for moving ahead. So taking a step back, this is a photo that Larry and Jim provided. Showing the original configuration here, when it was still used as a partially as a pier and a breakwater bowl before the build out of the marina. And so I'll talk through some graphics here in addition to the text here, but the original construction was 34 by the military, and it was a combination of creosote treated timber piles and whalers and armor rock. It's basically the same kind of structure that's there today. But then in 69, when it was slightly reconfigured and then developed into the small boat harbor, there was a major rehabilitation done then. And so for the most part, that's what we see today is what was rebuilt in 69, with the exception of the ends of the two breakwaters were retrofitted in 96. But for all intents and purposes, the majority of the structure that's there today is partially 69 vintage and partially 1934, which is 80 years old. So here's a cross section. This is actually to the north breakwater. And a couple things I want to point out here. This one's got the walkway on the top.
This is a combination type structure. It's actually quite, not unique. I've seen them used quite a bit, like in the Great Lakes and other areas, but it was actually pretty innovative for the time in 1934 for the available materials, the equipment available, and somewhat economical for the time. And the other thing that's interesting too is that because you have such a narrow entrance and not a lot of room, they went with this because they it was kind of the best of both worlds. It was a vertical wall that saved space, but it was rubble mound that helped dissipate wave energy versus if you just put a all pile structure out there, you know, you can get some wave reflection and things like that. So this was actually for its time a pretty innovative type structure. So the original structure were these interior piles here, the whalers, and then the stone, and then there's tie rods through here. So that's 1934. In 1969, the retrofit was putting the second row of piles, oh, my pointer's dying on me, on the exterior side, and some rehabilitation of the tie rods on the top as well. And so here's a photo of that here, giving a little better idea. So you can see interior row of piles and exterior row of piles. So that's the 34 to 69 vintage. And then the cabling, for the most part, was done. Oh, thank you. The cabling was in 69. Now you can see some stone up on top here. That was in that corner. This is, again, this is the north breakwater here, looking down towards Maristone. That was part of the rebuild in 94, just down the corner there. And so these two red boxes are the areas that were in 96. So just a little section here at the end of the south jetty, the breakwater, and then this section here in the corner. My understanding is the major, repair work or damage that occurred prior to 96 was the tip here in the corner. And that's typically where, if there's going to be major problems, it usually happens at, you know, a major change in alignment or at the end. So that's the most susceptible to damage and gets worked the hardest.
I guess the walkway must have been added right after that was done.
96, I believe.
Yeah, it was an RCO grant.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's that new. There wasn't a walkway prior to 96.
No.
Huh. Didn't know that. So, yeah, I forgot to mention, if there's any questions, stop me. Otherwise, I'll keep talking.
And we'll get the digits and print out copies of this and put it in your boxes just so you'll have a hard copy to kind of think about.
So, won't go into a lot of detail here, but basically, you know, creosote treated timber piling back in the day was really good quality for, they got good creosote treatment on it. Given that they're maintained, they can last a long period of time, but once you get splitting and you can get marine borers in there and rotting, and that interior core that doesn't have creosote, it starts to deteriorate pretty fast. And so typically what we've seen, the life expectancy of various piers around Puget Sound is anywhere from 35 to 80 years is what you can expect. The best quality wood with really good maintenance over time, you can get 80 years out of them. There's others where, you know, it's on the lower end. Timber whalers, typically you don't get as good a life out of those as you do out of piles. And then steel cable, we all know, in the marine environment, degrades pretty quickly. So, again, a lot of these are variable, but you can expect 20 to 30 years on that. On those.
So why don't they use stainless steel cables? I can never figure that out.
Here or in general?
In general.
In some applications, yeah, but it's very expensive.
Well, you only have to do it once. I mean, you put it in once and it lasts virtually forever, as opposed to having rotten steel ones every 20 to 30 years. And then, of course, that compounds the problem because when it rots, the thing falls apart and then you got to go rebuild it again.
Right. So that brings, so with that idea of what the history is, we'll talk through our site visit and our assessment or condition assessment of the breakwater. So for discussion purposes, we broke it down into five different segments. And again, this is a south breakwater, this is a north breakwater, and so the shoreward leg and seaward leg, and then three lakes here. This one here is kind of a special little section here. It's more like a bulkhead than a breakwater. So in comparing different alternatives, it's really these four have a lot of commonality from one to the other. There's variability from one to the other because of the depths. In the channel here, it's all consistently, between a minus 9 and a minus 13 mean level water. But on the outside, you see a lot of variability here as well as here. So again, the different components, the key parts of the structure are the cabling, and the cabling tie across, so you got the two rows of piles, the cables tie across and provide that lateral support for the piles, and the cabling are along each row of whalers. So there's a historical line of whaler here, and there's one up at the top, and then there was one that you can't see that's below the water line here. So depending on the height of the structure and the beach line, there's either two or three rows of whalers and tie rods, and the tie rod or the through rods or tie rods are the cables. Then, of course, you got all the exterior piles on both sides, and you have the rock on the interior. So those are the main structural components of this breakwater. And then, of course, we talk about the walkway. I'll talk about this a little bit more in a moment, but you can see some lateral shifting here of this outer end. This is the south breakwater tip. Similar area that was rebuilt in 1996. So first, talking about piles. So we went through both in a boat with Jim and Larry, and a variety of tight conditions. And then we got out on foot, both on top, in between some of the cables on the rock, and also on the walkway, and then we got down on the beach at low tide. So we got a good look kind of all over the place to get a representative sample of what we think that the pile condition is. And so in summary, what we saw was the interior piles, 1934 vintage, are in really bad condition. And that's to be expected. They're 80 years old. They're at the end of their life. They're providing very minimal structural capacity. Back in 69, when they rehabilitated, they had the combination of the new outer piles and the older inner piles both provided some lateral capacity to the system. But today, those inner piles have really no contribution for the most part. The outer piles were in somewhat okay condition. There, 10 to 20% of the piles seem to be in bad condition in general. Some areas were a little bit higher, 20 to 30%, but before getting out and taking a close look, I would expect the piles to be a little bit worse. But then again, as I mentioned, some of the older piles can get 50 to 80 years. So if it was 1969, that's 40 some years. So they are seeing deterioration, but they weren't nearly as bad as I had expected. Don't update on me now. All right. So this just shows here just a couple little things. Just some examples of poor condition. There's a lot of marine borer, interior rod. You can see a lot of cracking here. And that's what I was mentioning before. Once they crack, and marine borers and the wetting and drying action can get into that interior heartwood that doesn't have creosote, that's when it starts to deteriorate and deteriorates quickly. The creosote actually does a phenomenal job of protecting that outer ring of the timber. But once it's breached, they start to deteriorate a lot quickly. And this is another good example here. This is the outer pile. You can see how bad a condition some of those are in. Then, you know, on down the line, they're in okay condition. But the interior, they're completely rotted out in many places. This is on the north breakwater, exposed to the north. And here it's abrasion damage. So this, it's kind of hard to see with the lighting, but this is all kind of caved out from abrading with gravel and sand. That's common to see on beaches where you get lots of wave action and movement of sediment around. Is that it actually just tears apart the wood over time. And so you can see that here even on the newer piles. So in the upper beach areas, this is the phenomenon that you see is that you get loss of the section, not due to rot, but just due to the abrasion. Whereas in areas that are more in the interior and you get the fluctuating tidal action, you see the more of the interior decay of the piles.
So is there less sea life on these piles because of the abrasion? Seems like there's less.
Depending on elevation, yes. less sea life because, yeah, they're getting braided more, and it also could be because they're up a little bit higher elevation. These are below, this is below mean higher high, I think, so.
Are those 34 piles in the background? Yes, they are. I couldn't see around.
Right here, yeah. Yeah, so this one and this one are the 34 vintage, and then these are the 69. So then, kind of working our way through the structure, the next thing was the whalers. And in general, the whalers are in really, really bad condition. Like in here, we're saying whalers completely deteriorated, very minimal load carrying capacity, if any at all. And then other areas, they're, you know, highly deteriorated, but they're still partially functional.
Are there two sets of whalers? Is there a 34 set of whalers and a 69 set? I mean, do they put whalers between the outer 69 piles and the original?
I don't think so. Okay. Unfortunately, of the plans that we got, we had the plan view, but the sections, I suspect that they replaced the whalers in 69 as part of the rehabilitation and might have even put some new tension cables through as well. Not sure the details of how they would have done that, but I suspect that they were replaced. It could be that it may be a combination of both, older 34 and newer 69. But, you know, this shows some good examples here where the whaler's completely missing here. And then a little bit of remaining. This one, it's there, but it's like a skeleton. There's really no structural capacity there at all. So it kind of gives the appearance that there's something there and it's functional, but it really has minimal function.
So, Jeff, can I get back to a real basic question? These pilings and these whalers are there for the sole purpose of keeping the rock in place. Is that correct?
Well, the whalers, well, to back up, the piles provide, they're a component of a system to provide the lateral support for the rock. Mm-hmm. The whalers help distribute the load
between the piles,
and secondarily, they do help retain the rock. Now, the piles are spaced such that it's relative to the size of the rock that they put in, so that the rock is slightly bigger than the opening between the piles. And then the whalers also help transfer load to the tension cables that go over to the other side. And so they're all integrally related one to another. The stone is sort of standalone. It's the part that helps dissipate the wave energy. And they select the rock as well because they can reduce the number of piles and not have to have them so closely spaced.
So in other words, if something fails, then the ultimate thing is going to be that the rock's going to fall out.
Right.
If you keep the rock in without having those, you know, then we wouldn't even need all of this stuff. But I mean, the point is to keep the rocks in place.
Right, yeah. And again, it came down to space. It's a very narrow entrance. They wanted a rubble mound, but they couldn't make a traditional rubble mound with flat slopes work. They had to go vertical, and the only way to go vertical to retain that rock is through this structure system with the piles and the whalers and the padlocks. And then the steel cable tiebacks. On the surface, just looking at them visually before taking a closer look, there was about 10% that were severed on the south breakwater, 5 to 10% on this one, meaning they just were completely broken and not providing any continuity from one side to the other. And then in the outer part, it was more like 10 to 20% here. But under further inspection, that was just the top. The bottom, we suspect this is the lower row of cabling here. We suspect many of those are broken, and you can see many of them broken. And they're in a higher corrosion zone here. It's the, you know, they're immersed almost every day in saltwater, whereas here it's just the splash and spray.
Now those cables don't go from one pile to the next. Those cables go from one pile through the rock into the other pile adjacent to it.
So they're parallel to these
all
here, just down below.
Yeah.
And what's left is going to be on the verge of parting at any time.
Right, and so that's this here. So what we did is there's this little tail off this clamp. We decided to take a hammer to it, and you know, we didn't want to compromise any load capacity of the system, so it's just on the tail. But just hitting it with a hammer, it went from appearing to be completely solid and intact and just being a little rusty to about half of the diameter. And so that's a substantial difference in capacity of the system. And just visually looking at it, it looks much better than it actually is. So we suspect the majority of these cable systems might only have, at best, a third of their original design capacity. That's an important point. When I'll show a slide here in a moment, kind of combining all this together, what does it mean? There's a lot of reliance on the cables to keep this whole system in place, and a lot of the cables are a much reduced capacity.
I got a question, kind of back to the condition of the pile and pile penetration. Maybe Ty can answer this. What's our area like here in regards to the sand gribbles that eat into the piling below the sand? I mean, I've been around, seen a lot of piling being pulled in various areas where there's real active sand gribbles going on, and it's like there's hardly anything left below the sand level layer.
There's not too much of that up here. The big problem is, like Shane says, the creosote rind on the outside, and it's the inside. A lot of times you'll find more damage on the inside than there is on the outside.
Yeah.
We discussed a little bit earlier, you're asking about the penetration. Excuse me. You know, I talked to the contractor that did the 69 job, who is up the older than I am, but he didn't remember the whole job, but the piles that were for first order were too short, so as Shane had brought up, some of these are probably have fairly shallow penetration. And then they had to, answering Pete's question, they replaced a few whalers, but not many. There are some of the newer tie cross ties. They moved a lot of rock and they added a lot of rock, so you will find a few of the through ties that are in the rock at that time that went clear across it are probably failed. I was down today and looked, and I was surprised that there's more of them than I thought when we looked at it a couple months ago.
More than a failed, you mean?
Yes. Uh-huh. And then the pile that he showed you on slide 16, they're tied at the top and fixed at the bottom, and they're getting this flexure loading, bending them, and there, that was a good example. As I looked at it, there's quite a few of them that have considerable amount of bending them now, so they're starting to get to a stage of quite overload.
But what I've seen on a lot of the creosote-treated timber structures in a marine environment, that they may be in really bad condition above the midline, but some short distance below the mudline and down to the tip, oftentimes they look like the day they are installed. They're a lot of times.
I've seen it both ways, though. I mean, I've seen some pulled where it's like it looked like it was almost gone. I mean, from, you know, but it's these little, we call them sand gribbles, and they're a marine borer, but they live in the sand.
Hmm. Yeah, that's very common in Southern Sound. I haven't seen much of that up there.
Okay.
We pulled the piles of AB dock from the mudline down. They were
When we pulled all the piles at Point Hudson, when we did the marina redo in 2006, you could still read, it was like brand new, the imprint code numbers on the pile.
Right. You know. And so this is a good picture here of the 96 work. There's some recabling work done that when we walked out here, we can only get so far. There's so many cables running around. Not sure if that really added any additional capacity or not, but there's a lot of redundancy there, I guess.
More is better.
Yeah. And so the last component is armor rock. And so what we found on armor rock in general, that about 10 to 15% of the voids in the face, we weren't really looking in the interior. The most important part is the face, where it comes in contact with the piles. What's the condition of that? Because if that starts to slump away, then it starts to unravel further in. And then that's loss along the face is an indicator of kind of an exacerbating problem that will start to accelerate. And so about 10 to 15% of surface area, there was some displacement of rock in there. So a little bit less than I had expected, but what was slightly worse than expected was the condition of the rock. And we do a lot of breakwater rehab work, rubble mound. And so this is indicative of the kind of marine basalt that comes like from down Fort Ludlow at Mats. There's different variability of quality that came out of that pit. Some of it was good, some of it wasn't so good. And kind of hit or miss, but this is pretty similar to what we'd see there. So it's prone to degradation in the saltwater environment and, you know, cracking. There's a lot of seams and whatnot, and that's what you see here. I mean, these were just a couple of examples, but what happens in this type of structure, though, is it was sized to be retained between the vertical piles, but as soon as it splits in half or it splits even into additional pieces, it can fall out. And then once it falls out, additional rock falls down, and it starts to deteriorate the entire structure. So just looking at the stone quality, I estimated that greater than 50% of the stone is in deteriorated or highly deteriorated state. So the stone's not in that good a condition.
And as the whole structure fails more and you get rocking motion with large sea conditions, it's going to exacerbate that problem.
Right.
The harbor problem.
Right. Yeah, and the structure will move more too as you lose more rock. I already went over that. Oh yeah, this is at the end of the the south. I can't remember if this is
the south.
Yeah, the very end of the south breakwater, I think.
And that's substantial where you see the rock, armor rock.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of rock missing from the inside here.
It's supposed to be full of rock, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure the original structure you couldn't see daylight on the other side.
Right.
At least not much.
Another example here, I think this is on a corner. So there's a couple locations where there's quite a bit of rock gone. Other than those two locations, it's just localized little areas. And this one here, oh, this was on the corner on the bulkhead.
Yeah, it's on the inside of the marina.
Right. And then this is that outer segment of the south breakwater where the walkway is, where that 96 repair work was done. And so again, you can see some of these pile caps kind of tilted a little bit, which indicates the structure's shifted out this direction. And so this is an area that needs to keep a close watchful eye on, that, you know, it's already started to move a little bit. And so it's susceptible to damage, especially during the storm. But yeah, this section here, you can see a bunch of the stone missing here. That's, like I say, that's probably contributed to the...
With the tidal motion along the waterfront, ebb and flow, ebb and flood, are you able to determine, when you put a structure in the ground, can you say, okay, over 50 years, it's actually going to shift this way along the shoreline just by virtue of how the beach is going to move with the ebb?
Meaning like sediment movement and things
like
that? Well,
sediment movement, but actual structural movement too. I mean, you're going to have, you know, the current going one way with the ebb, going the other way with the flood, and it's not always the same. Sometimes, you know, it consistently is actually stronger one way than the other way.
Right.
So that would lead you to say, okay, the structure is going to move a little bit south or a little bit north over a long period of time.
Well, we didn't do during this phase, but one of the capabilities we have is we do numerical analysis of tidal currents and waves and the interaction of those with structures, both for giving an idea of what kind of change in the hydrodynamics you can expect if you did a new structure or some reconfiguration. It also gives you an idea of what kind of loads you can expect on those structures for design. So so we can evaluate that. We can also evaluate if you change somehow the configuration of the breakwater, we can evaluate is there an effect on longshore sediment transport, meaning you have a beach that's built up on a little bit on both sides of the breakwaters. How is that beach going to adjust if you make any changes to the structure? And a change to the structure might not even be the alignment. It might just be the structure type, because this is fairly porous structure on the north end. You do get sediment that leaks through the voids and deposits into the marina. It's a slow rate, but it does migrate through, and that's pretty common on rubble mound structures. If you put a fixed pile, like sheet pile or something like that, that's solid, there won't be any sediment that leaks through. More of that's going to get built up on the updrift side, and eventually, if there's enough time, enough sediment volume coming through, your beach can build out. Just here, there's, looks like there's been some, minor repair work on the walkway handrail. And this just, again, this was on that section that's kind of shifted out. This was another good indicator of what's going on there. The railing shifted out with the remainder of the structure, and then the power caps have rotated over. So, in summary, again, the whalers and the steel cable tieback systems are in the probably the worst condition. The armor rock is in bad condition. The pile, outer piles are in okay. Overall, the structural system is substantially less stable than what it was originally constructed, and a much higher stresses because you don't have that lateral support of the lower level whalers and steel cable system. South breakwater, a couple of stringers are nearly unseated. The entire 60-foot section is partially failed. It's that part I talked about that's kind of shifted, leaning seaward. And the walkway is in, seems to be in, okay, in good moderate condition. So where does that lead us to when we start wanting to talk about alternatives? The maintenance or repair of the existing structure is most likely not viable alternative, just because of the condition of all these different materials. And one might say, well, could we replace the lower whaler or put a new through rod system in to help provide additional support, even if the, if the piles were in okay condition? And the answer would be, it'd be extremely difficult because you have to basically take the structure apart to put it back. And anytime something that's old, this old, you start to mess with it and take it apart, you're going to end up with even a more deteriorated structure to start with doing any rehab work. So really what we're looking at is a major rehabilitation or a replacement. I'll talk about what those mean. But first, on the analysis, this is kind of a crude little graphic here, but so this is the original condition here. So we had this is the exterior pile. The rock was on the interior here, not shown. So there's a whaler here, in some cases a third lower whaler with cables going across. So that provided support so that this pile for the all the mass of rock pushing out, these cables help provide support on this timber pile. Under the current condition, what we have is all these lower ones failed. All that load is on this single pile, and so there's a lot more bending moment on this for the same capacity of a pile. So the loads are much higher, probably, at least twice, if not more, now than they were before. But the pile is in a deteriorated, it's not in a new condition, it's deteriorated from what the original condition is. So you got less capacity of the pile and more load. I think I already went over that. So any questions on that before getting into some of the alternatives? So, we compiled a list of...
I do have a question. Did you do, before we get into replacement, did you do an analysis of a worst case scenario in terms of a failure, catastrophic failure? Like, are you going to address that at some point in your presentation?
I'm not sure.
We get a sustained wind of 40 knots out of the southeast and a flood tide. Are we looking at a potential system failure?
That's what I would suspect, is if you're going to see a larger failure, you're going to see associated with some sort of a winter storm.
Right.
And I would suspect it's going to be in some of these areas that are the most highly compromised. And this area is one of them. Again, the ends and the changes in alignment are the areas usually most susceptible. They're the ones that we found to be in the worst condition right now. So that would be the end of the south breakwater. Let's go back to the site plan here. That would be this section here, this section right here. To a lesser extent, maybe this here, this was in a deteriorated state as well, but it doesn't get hit by waves nearly as much since it's on the interior here. This, you know, any of the areas have the potential of having a failure, but just looking at the current condition, those areas I just talked about are the most susceptible. Exactly what type of storm that is, you know, we didn't get into that kind of detail, and it'd be hard to quantify that. That's more kind of qualitative than quantitative.
And with this type of structure, is it possible you would see a complete failure in one event like a storm, or is this something that a storm would aggravate and you would see a slower unwinding of the system?
I think you could see both. I think you could see localized areas of damage where a pile fails and maybe some rock falls out locally, but the entire thing doesn't collapse. I think out here there is the potential, because of the condition it's in, there could be a more catastrophic failure here during a major storm. But, you know, it kind of depends. The other thing is that if you get the bad set of combination of a large number of piles adjacent to one another over a distance, all in bad condition, and a high loading scenario, and they all fail at the same time, then you could get a more catastrophic failure there as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
So, replacement options. This is based on experience working around Puget Sound, given some of the constraints of the site that I'll talk about. So there's vertical pile barrier, raised vertical pile barrier, closed cell wall, rubble mound, and then this is an exterior soldier pile system. That's basically putting a new pile and encapsulating the existing structure in place and not removing it. So these upper four would require removing the existing structure in there in its entirety. This one would leave at least a portion or not most of the structure in place. Considerations. There's many considerations here. Now, some of these, because of where we're at and the information we have, we had to use some assumptions based on previous project experience, such as, you know, the regulatory requirements. Generally, we know what those are around Puget Sound, but oftentimes it can be project specific and be specific to the personnel involved that's going to be writing the permit. And there hasn't been much dialogue with them yet because we're still in the process of evaluating coming up with some alternatives. Habitat, eelgrass, forage fish habitat are important elements. The eelgrass is a big thing. It would be south of the south breakwater. If we were going to replace it with a regular rubble mound structure with a big footprint, want to make sure that you don't extend out into the eelgrass beds, because that would create some additional mitigation. Wave reflection at the entrance is an important consideration. That would be if you get too much solid wall parallel to one another, depending on the angle of the waves coming in. We wouldn't want to have waves bouncing back and forth, sloshing effect. You don't have that as much right now because you have a rubble mound. Wave protection for the boat basin, of course, we want it to be the same or better for wave protection, not worse. Question earlier about sediment processes, that's a consideration too. Whatever you do in a reconfiguration, you want to make it the same or better as well. And typically that comes up with the regulatory agencies. They want to know whatever you're proposing isn't going to have a detrimental impact on longshore sediment processes. Entrance channel width, we understood that, you know, it's really narrow for some of the size vessels that utilize this facility now. And so anytime you start talking about a major reconstruction, it gives the opportunity to open up your entrance to allow safer transit of larger vessels. But at the same time, you still need to provide that same wave protection. Public access, whether there's requirements for that or not, is also a consideration. And of course, construction cost and long-term maintenance. So these are all things, some quantitative, some qualitative at this point, that are considerations in developing the alternatives and then evaluating the alternatives for comparison. Some of these things will need to be looked at in a little more detail once an alternative is picked. So,
one quick question. So when you look at the current structure, in the, like the angles to the beach and you know how the parallels work and so forth, you know, it seems like it works well how it's designed in terms of the footprint, how it's laid out to the entrance and the way and stuff. Do you take that into account, like, gosh, you know, whether we replace it or not, it may be about right as far as how it's configured?
Yeah, we did a, I guess, a qualitative perspective. In the next step, we take a little closer look using some of those models that we have. They're fairly easy and don't take a whole lot of effort to get them up and going. We've done wave modeling and tidal circulation modeling work for other projects we've done in the area, like the Washington State Ferries and the Fort Townsend Terminal and that, so we can adapt that to here pretty efficiently. And so we'd be able to take a closer look at it, just to be able to give you folks some information of, if you do change some configuration, is there a benefit? And the benefit could be maybe changing, not necessarily the exact configuration of South Breakwater, but maybe extending it out a little bit or slightly changing that. There might be a benefit of reducing the length of the interior breakwater, but we'd have to do some of that analysis to quantify that and finalize that. That would help open up the entrance a little bit, but not allow any more waves or sediment to enter into the basin.
Could I add to that? Debris collection, that's part of the best drift with collector and drop thing.
Uh-huh. It bypasses around
the entrance? Down the shoreline and into the marina.
Oh, so it does come right into the marina?
Oh, yeah. We have a tour out of there, big stuff.
From the north, south or from north?
Yeah, from Port Gordon.
Seems like that might be collector collection. I consider that.
Yeah, it's a good point, because then what it does is it hits the linear dock, that long linear dock, and works its way between boats that are more there.
We've lost some pretty astonishing logs out there before.
That's right. When we looked at the Hat Island Marina, we reconfigured their entrance breakwaters for some similar reasons. They had a little too much wave energy coming into their boat basin, but it was also too narrow. They wanted to open it up, so reconfigured it with some rubble mound and sheet pile, and to reduce sedimentation in their entrance channel. So we're able to do all that. One of the kind of added benefits that I can't claim we exactly predicted it, but they had a lot of debris problems as well coming into their boat basin. And in the post-project condition, they actually get a lot less debris the way the breakwaters are configured and the way the currents are. It comes in from the south there, and it seems to bypass the debris to entrance more and then continue on down the shoreline rather than get sucked into the boat basin. So that's kind of a combination of currents and waves. So that could be an opportunity to mitigate that as well. So the different options. So this one's a vertical pile breakwater. This is actually Hat Island here. It's basically, we call it a combination wall. It's a steel pipe pile with Z sheets. So you alternating from pipe pile to Z sheet. And then it's transitioned into a rubble mound structure. And same thing on the other side. So you can see here, often, not necessarily all the time, but sometimes you'll have a rock toe on here too to help protect against scour. Makes it for a more efficient design of the structure. This here is a similar thing. It's steel sheet pile. It's got a concrete cap, and then it's got concrete batter piles. This is actually in Edmonds, right near the fish. This is a fishing pier right here, or the access out to the fishing pier. And then this is a near shore portion that connects into the rubble mound breakwater. The difference between these two, the batter piles provide a lot more lateral support. It's got a lot more capacity to resist wave loads. So this is a beefier structure than this. This might be something that might be needed depending on what the load conditions are in some of the deeper sections of your breakwater. Typically, this works really well in the minus 15 depth, or bottom elevation on up. You can go deeper with it, but it starts to get more expensive.
How wide is those caps on the braced?
This here?
Yeah, what's the width right
this
there?
This one, I think it's like 2.5 feet on this here.
They wouldn't be capable of putting a walkway on top of that?
You can make the cap wider.
Okay.
It's just additional concrete, but it's possible, especially with batter piles. I mean, with the batter piles and the cap on there, this is another 3 feet here.
Yeah, so you can expand. We can get 4 feet out of it or something.
Right.
Well, because I don't really mention earlier that it wasn't walkway before 96, but there actually was. It was a catwalk. And that light at the end is unnatural. You know, so if we can't get to it via catwalk or something, we'll have to do it in a boat.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's a work problem. If we get full curb permission, take it out.
And so the other two, this is the closed cell wall. Basically, it's a sheet pile driven in a circular manner and then filled with soil or stone and then capped on the top. An example of one being built here. There's pros and cons to all these. This is a wider footprint, but it's not individual piles. And, it's more of a beefier structure. But, you know, it gives a lot bigger footprint on the top as well. This is more economical when you get out into deeper depths and higher exposed heights. And then, of course, rubble mound here. This is the project we did up at Capistani Marinas over to the left here. So this is the Anacortes looking out towards Mount Baker. And this was a new construction. And so as you can see here, you know, this is a typical kind of strict construction with a bedding and a core and an armor layer. And you can see the footprint. And this is the scale between these two. So you can see the footprint is substantially bigger for this than for that. So the rubble mound, although, you know, we've got some good rock sources. They're very durable. They last a long, have very long service life. They have a limit on their feasibility relative to depth. You don't want to go too deep with them because then the footprint gets huge and they can get quite expensive. So they're really good at the near shore.
I can't read that. Does that say 160 feet for the width of the rubble mound?
In this example here, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the diameter of the closed cell breakwaters? You say it's a bunch of sheet piles pounded in a circle and then...
Yeah, you know, it varies, and it depends on the design conditions and the type of piling that you select. I think in this one, I want to guess it was 12 or 18 foot diameter, maybe 18.
Mm-hmm. And what's the width of our existing breakwater out there now?
Oh, boy.
40? I was going to say
25. 40, but at least 25. Well, it varies. When you get out where it's spread out on the outer end, maybe 30 feet.
Right. So, yeah, 25 to 30-ish feet. So this would fit within the footprint, maybe be even smaller footprint than what you got right now.
I'm not clear how that works. You put a bunch of sheet piles in a circle and then fill the middle with something, and what's between this one and the other one adjacent to it?
Well, it's hard to see here, but there's connector sheets between the two circular ones.
Okay, so there's a circular sheet pile and a sheet pile and another circular sheet
right.
pile.
Yeah. There's various combinations. You can do some of these with some strategic location of pipe piles as well. But for the most part, generally they're made out of some form of sheet pile, both around the circular part, and then they'll have interlocks that help connect the sheets that connect between these two. They go in typically quite efficiently, but there's a lot of pile, you know, a lot of surface area, sheet pile here. And that's the other thing is that long term, you know, steel corrodes, so the more surface area you have, the more you have to do maintenance on. You know, coating systems only last so long, and they need to be maintained. Whereas the rubble mound, if you get really good quality rock up front, it's minimal maintenance unless, you know, you get displacement of stone during a major storm, you have to go out and fix some of that. For the most part, there's a lot less maintenance with a structure like this.
The two benefits of reducing the width of the new breakwater is, one, you can widen the entrance to the marina a little bit, but also it helps in the permitting and the mitigation if we're covering less of the tideland.
So these two would have the least amount of footprint of any of them.
So in that sheet pile, then, would that be like a 50-year lifespan?
Typically, yeah. You know, really, any pile structure.
Breakwater is 100 in total, right?
With good quality rock, yeah, you can get easily 70.
So we have to reduce current into the metal one as well to get 50 out, right?
Right, yeah, you can, you know, with the, there's also options
not really that long.
For concrete and with the steel, you know, you can do cathodic protection systems and coating. But really, when it comes to steel structures, it's doing the maintenance over time. You have to build that in. If you're diligent about maintaining the coating and putting the cathodic protection systems in and maintaining those, you can really extend the life of the steel structures. But if you don't, then, you know, it's definitely shortens the life quite substantially. So this was the leave it in place and build around it, which would be new outboard, like steel piles. Doesn't show whether there'd have to be a whaler system in here too. And then new through rods, and then new rock. So basically you're just encapsulating the whole thing. But you're also expanding the footprint and narrowing your channel. And as Larry mentioned, there's, you know, potential complications with the regulatory permitting as well. Rather than reducing footprint, you're expanding footprint. When we looked at the cost, this is actually one of the more expensive options, surprisingly. It's not less. It's comparable to the others. So there's not a big advantage of doing this unless it was some reason for, you know, a short fix somewhere, you know, in a localized area as an emergency repair.
Would that also have a potential future problem if the interior wood continues to deteriorate, creating a void?
Yeah.
You know, hollow points.
Right. Yeah. Within the... This is definitely not the ideal solution, but we looked at it from the perspective of, well, how does it compare for cost? If there was a substantial difference of cost, it might change how you look at the alternatives. But also as a short-term repair or, you know, kind of mitigation to buy some more time, what would the cost to do that? And, you know, it's based on some order magnitude as replacing. And so this was the rubble mound, just to give an idea of the difference in footprint between a mud line elevation of zero, this is mean low water data, and a minus 20. And the minus 20 is what you could expect to see at the outer tip of the south breakwater. It's double the footprint. And that's what I was saying earlier, is that in the shallower areas, the rubble mound is a good option. But out here, you know, you're potentially doubling the volume of rock and doubling the cost as well, and complicating the regulatory permitting. So what we found is on the outer leg of the south breakwater, the rubble mound isn't feasible. So this was our little matrix of different types of alternatives based on what we've done today. So these are the different alternatives here, the sheet pile wall, the brace wall, the closed cell, rubble mound, and the exterior piles encapsulating existing structure. And then these are the different locations, south breakwater inner, south breakwater outer, and same thing on the north breakwater. So the check mark is, it's feasible, you know, but the relative cost, there's some difference and performance differential on some of them, but the X's are what we're able to eliminate right away, that it wouldn't be feasible, it wouldn't be cost feasible, or just really stood out that it wouldn't work. So even this one here, our conclusion was it could work on some segments of it, but not all of it. And as I mentioned here, there's some limitations on this one. So really the only one that could work, the two that could work on every single segment, are these two. But there's no reason you can't do combinations of these different alternatives.
So you could do the vertical on the north one,
right,
and the braced on the south.
Right, and possibly rubble mound for a portion of the, you know, the near shore area. That, you know, that's an area that sees a lot more abrasion, as I mentioned, on the timber piles. We've seen that also on steel or concrete piles. It could be a lot of abrasion in that near shore area. It could lead to some, you know, future maintenance needs. So oftentimes the rubble mound works really well in that near shore environment. Some regulatory things we have to work through on that. The good news is there's a variety of different combinations of alternatives. It's just a matter of looking at all those variables I mentioned, the permitting, the performance, the cost, the maintenance, and all those things to narrow down what the best alternative is for which segment of each breakwater.
I guess I just talked about this.
So would these be in the same configuration as existing runners?
Yeah, so for this phase, because of the time that we had available, we just focused on the existing footprint and didn't look at
not changing the configuration at all.
Yeah, and that made it a lot easier and simpler. So if we look at some variation of a footprint, it might add or subtract 10 or 15% cost, or maybe 20%. But for the most part, it's not going to drastically change the lengths of the breakwaters. That would be 50% more or anything like that.
Because I know it's large boats have a little problem with that jogging and
right
during the storm, especially. And is that still in there? So I think it has to be.
that would be the next step is, once the alternatives are narrowed down, then the next step would be to do some of that wave analysis and tidal circulation analysis and look at different configurations to see if there's a benefit of changing that, what's the associated cost, and that would help optimize whether there's any justification to change the configuration of the brake pliers. So getting down to costs, so we broke it down again into those four segments, and these are the different alternatives. And these are, this is in thousands of dollars per foot.
We get this, right? This whole presentation?
I have copies on your box.
Generally, we talk about breakwaters for these types of facilities around Puget Sound. You can expect anywhere from $3,000 to $7,500 per lineal foot for breakwaters. Doesn't matter what type of structure. You know, if we're talking about a boat harbor that's at a minus 10 to minus 12 depth for the harbor and entrance channel, that's what you can expect. So we knew that going into this, and so these numbers fall into that quite well. There's a few that are a little bit higher than that. There's some as high as 10,000, but that's because of, you know, some uniqueness of this site. But generally, you know, on this leg, it's anywhere from 5,000 to 6,500 per foot. Similar here. One alternative up to 9,000. Actually, that's the exterior soldier pile. It's actually more expensive to encapsulate the existing than to just replace it. And then out here, looking at the braced wall, the close cell wall. So, so what does that mean? It's just adding that up or multiplying it times the length of that segment to get a total cost. This just gives a different kind of breakdown relative to that's the other thing we did, is we looked at each one of these alternatives relative to these different beach levels or mudline elevations. So a 0, minus 5, minus 10, minus 20. These are different combinations along those four segments. And then we got a cost comparison per lineal foot. And so, as I mentioned before, the rubble mound out at that outer section is extremely expensive. So that just moved that off the list. But the rubble mound can be very competitive, as you see here, in the nearshore area. So this exercise helped us kind of narrow down which alternative for which location. And this is the total cost. This is the low cost is the lowest cost for each segment of the break, these four segments, whatever the lowest cost alternative was. And then this column is the highest cost alternative for that segment. And that generates a range of cost. So the total cost to replace all four segments is somewhere in the range of $3 to $4.5 million. And that's construction cost. So, you know, some engineering and permitting data collection requirements as well. And then this doesn't include the walk, if there was a walkway that needed to be reconstructed on top. Some alternatives, that cost is minimal. Other alternatives, it's a bit more, a little more complicated depending on which alternative was picked.
In your low cost, I would guess a lot of that was up one more.
This one or this one?
That one. So in your low cost, a lot of that would be the braced pile, looked like from the previous two slides. Seem to be the
pulmonary hazard and potential system, BP.
Oh yeah,
right.
Yeah, and so with that, like Larry was saying, with the braced pile system, I mean, a walkway could be pretty
doable
right. Cost wise, because you have a lot of the structure there.
And just so you, on the walkway, we checked with RCO since they funded the current walkway.
Yeah.
And their initial assessment was that the current walkway has served its useful life.
Okay.
So I don't think the state is going to require us to reinstall a walkway. Now, Eric checked the duty server at the city, and the city might want us to reinstall the walkway. Now, that's an issue we may have to discuss, and I don't know what you know, a commission.
They'll give us $1 million easement to do that.
We'll sell it to you.
That's good thinking.
But if we have to go down that road, if we choose an option that could accommodate a walkway, I would recommend that it not be done as part of this project. That it's doable, but we make that a later project, go back to RCO for new funding, you know, to do that as public access and all, because there is money for that.
How about, though, the fact that, like, a braced walkway could affect, I mean, it's already kind of incorporated into the structure, so. Yeah, I see.
May I ask, though, if the, listen, induced current systems out there, don't they have to be accessed from the top to maintain them? Should there at least be a catwalk up top? Or, you know, if we're going to use it, you know, induced current, right, to a cruise, and won't we have to access it from the top of that cheek wall?
You know, it depends.
Because it seems to me that's normally what happens. I mean, it would be a minimum catwalk to even go out and inspect it without.
Yeah, that would be different if it was the maintenance catwalk versus the public.
Right.
Well, I'm talking about the minimum would be a catwalk, not a public.
No, right.
So I'm just asking the question.
But like, how does, so there's Hat Island with the light at the end. How does Hat Island deal with that light?
Well, this, you know, they've got this all signed so people don't come out here, and they have some fencing up now, but this cap is wide enough that somebody, they're somewhat stable. I did make it up here and I didn't go any further.
You keep the 3700
And the other thing we could look at, since it's a fairly long breakwater on the south side and it's got that jog, maybe do a public access out to that last jog, and then that last section, just do a maintenance kind of a catwalk or something.
Excuse me. Comparing alternative two, the brace pile, and alternative three, the closed cell, which of those is substantially more resistant to elision or collision by a vessel, say a fairly large vessel?
Both for the size vessels that would be using this.
Let's say a loose barge.
A loose barge, definitely this is a lot more durable for large loading. This concept is used for a lot of larger vessel terminals, like for tankers and bulk carriers and stuff like that.
The mass helps you.
What's that?
The mass helps you.
Right, yeah. The only weak link here is, and these batter piles, you know, whether they're concrete or steel, are pretty strong, but if you had a really big vessel that hit it really hard, you could get some localized damage on the batter pile. So there's some susceptibility to that, but I mean, it's a normal boat just bumping into it, it's not going to cause any damage, it's going to damage the boat.
So kind of over to Larry's concern about protecting the steel. My concern is that if we, you know, in the olden days, they put in wooden piling and creosoted them, and that was it. You didn't have to go back and do anything. It just lasted. On new ones, if you have a steel pile and it's got either a galvanized coating on it or some other coating, that will wear away, and then you have to go back and you're not going to be able to galvanize it again, so you have to do something else like paint it, which is an ever-ending process, or use cathodic protection. And so is that something that can be mitigated by using concrete piles? Would it require that at all?
Yeah, definitely. That, you know, there's benefits to the concrete over the steel. I mean, they perform slightly differently. The design's slightly different. You know, it depends on the quality of the concrete as well. And I mean, with concrete, as long as you maintain your cover and you don't get exposure of your reinforcing to corrosion, then the concrete can outlast the steel. But as soon as you get any, you know, salt water penetration and corrosion of the reinforcing, then it'll start to come apart and fall. And then they're, you know, you start end up having the same, not the same, but similar levels of maintenance on concrete piles at some point as well. So, I mean, ultimately, if you get some spalling of concrete off that could happen due to freeze-thaw or other reasons, you have to go out and maintain that as well, just like you do with a steel structure. If you start losing coating everywhere, you know, in some, not galvanized, but coated, you can recoat it. And like you said, with cathodic protection, you've got the passive and active system. One's electrified and the other one's just sacrificial anodes. Both have, you know, kind of pluses and minuses, but those will extend the life of the steel. This one here is actually a combination. It's sheet pile, which is steel, but it's a concrete cab with concrete piles, so it's a combination of both.
So what is the design life of a concrete pile as opposed to a steel pile in this area?
Well,
I know Indian Island over there, they're having a heck of a time. I mean, they're replacing pile like crazy that's only 20 years old.
Concrete. I generally say 20.
I'll throw a little at, don't judge anything on Indian Island piles.
Oh, okay.
It goes clear back to the construction. And that's a whole separate case. Don't even think about that. Port of Seattle has had great success with them, except for the front row of piles and the piers. Problem with the concrete pile, pre-stressed, is the pre-stressing hasn't shrunk together. And most concrete piles after driving are a series of cracks. They're held together by the tension in the rebar, in the reinforcing. And concrete piles are great for load bearing, but they don't like to be flexed. And so that was the problem they had. Like Shane had just pointed out, you get flexure in the piles, and you have to, they're going to an oversized concrete pile now, diameter wise, to take care of that flexing so that you don't get the cracking, because the rebar is only in about, or reinforcing about 2 inches in. And once that salt water gets to it, they start to go, and you get the spalling. And they look great. You got sea life growing on the outside of them, and all of a sudden somebody bumps them, and ooh, we got a broken pile. So you have to look at that factor into the concrete size design. So normally the current practice is to oversize concrete piles.
And the bigger the piles, the bigger equipment.
The bigger
concrete.
That's what I'm just going to bring up. What you also have to consider is the exposure that this project has construction wise. And look at your fish window for construction, July 15th to February 15th. And with the activities the port has, like with the Boat Haven, we couldn't start until after the middle of September. So you need to look at a design that can possibly start in July and not interfere with anything. But then you have to face a real bad weather exposure for the outside, and it takes some real heavy equipment, no matter what materials you're using. So there's a lot of consideration has to be put to the type of design and the building of it.
And this type of structure here, although, you know, this is a good option, this is a lot of formed concrete. It takes a while to get it all formed up, pour the concrete, make sure that everything's sealed up. You don't want concrete leaking into the water. Whereas, you know, some of these other alternatives, you minimize the on-site concrete work, the construction process goes much quicker. And generally, these combination wall systems like this, as long as the contractor sets up a good template, has a good plan for putting them in place, they go pretty quick. So,
could the braced system be built on the outside of the south breakwater, totally built, finished, and then come back and demolish the old breakwater on the inside, thereby expanding the channel some 25 feet or so.
Right.
And protecting the marina the whole time. You know, you don't have that storm event in November or something while we're trying to work.
It's definitely a possibility. It's, you know, we'll have to take a close look at the eelgrass, where the eelgrass is relative to that. I don't think it's up that close to the structure.
Right.
But you'd have to get the batter, you know, batter pile has to be some distance outboard of the existing structure. So whatever, you know, a buffer here is plus the width of this is how much further out it's going
to
be.
We have to look at that.
And then looking at the waves and the entrance, it's going to open up the entrance. We have to make sure that we're not going to exacerbate. Well,
plus, we're in the process of updating our port management agreement with DNR.
Oh yeah.
And I need to review that, because the breakwater is on, technically on state tidelands, but we have a PMA where we control it. And I gotta verify how far out that boundary is.
Right. Actually, at Hat Island, that was a major design condition where, actually right here, their tideland is just a couple feet out beyond this. This was supposed to be out another 10 feet, and we had to pull it back because DNR said that they wanted some astronomical amount of money for the small.
That's the trouble private marinas have to pay for, whereas by state law, we can.
Right.
What are the piles at the ferry dock, those black piles on the dolphins?
They're plastic.
No, they're a steel with a real heavy epoxy type finish on them.
Okay.
Which has stood up real well, except if it gets a crack or a scratch in it, Pete, the rust gets in behind it and it eats it back and you don't realize that it's doing that, and all of a sudden a great big chunk of the paint comes off. And you got this huge area of a rusty steel pile.
There was a bunch of the new marina down the Tacoma, the Theophos Waterway, that used those piles.
Yeah, I had a question. Suppose you had a budget of $2 million. Is it possible to, as Larry was implying, stage this thing and actually get a secure structure by doing the outer part and then later we do the retrofit on the inner part?
Well, you could definitely phase the project. No question about that. Sorry, let's see if I can find a site plan. It's definitely a possibility to build outboard of this, given you can get it permitted. I don't think it's going to add a lot more construction cost, if anything. It might be a little more cost efficient for the reasons you mentioned. But to answer your question, for $2 million, if we're replacing all four, it's $3 to $4 or $4.5 million. So I don't think there's any combination that could get us down to $2 million, but you could potentially phase it in doing one versus the other. That's the other thing I forgot to mention earlier. When we did our condition assessment, we were hoping the outcome would be maybe one's much worse than the other, but really the two are somewhat comparable. I mean, you can find isolated areas that's worse in one versus the other, but if you look at kind of holistically, they're both generally in the same order of magnitude conditions. So
north versus south, you're
saying? Right. Yeah.
But the south takes the brunt of the storm.
Right.
Energy.
So it's probably got a little higher risk.
Because it's the prevailing, you know, southerlies, you know, smacking it out and it blankets the north.
That's why I was thinking if we could somehow do that first.
Yeah, if we could do the south part, that's the long part that you, I think, indicated could be a rubble mound out. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I meant the north part. There could be a rubble mound. That part right there, do that rubble mound. And then, like Larry was saying on the south one, you have an option of leaving that existing one in. If we chose the sheet pile, you could sheet pile right up next to it on the outside. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have to leave room for the bracing pile. And then you could, at your leisure, remove the inside after the outside has been put in.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do is put the sheet pile in and the toe on the outside. And you'd take off the inside and put the toe on the inside, and you'd be done.
Although we got to be mindful that a lot of costs in these type projects is the mobilization cost. So I would recommend we put the new one in, but then also remove it right away while you got all the barges and the cranes there. And, but the other thing we got to, you know, this is a huge revenue producing facility of ours. And Wooden Boat Festival and all that. You know, the actual destruction of the current breakwater or messing around with the north breakwater prior to Labor Day is going to be problematic. And that's going to impact on the ability to use the marina. And so if there's something we could do that we worked on the outside during the good weather of July, August, and September, allowing the boaters to, all the yacht clubs to come and go and the Wooden Boat Festival, and right after the Wooden Boat Festival, and just, you know, full steam ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And try to get it all done before.
What are the construction costs rising per year now? Because we've seen 5 to 10% per year. And yes, some years, I think it was more than that. Do you know what they are now? 2 year delay would add 10% to the project, or would add more?
I would expect those kinds of increases. But
first, well, there's a fluctuation because of the way the steel prices, if anything has steel or
not. Steel goes up monthly.
Well, it goes up and
down.
It goes down, you can't, but there has been an average maybe of a 5% average. Some years it's up, some years it's down. So we found out
the steel prices will drive the cost a bit more than the contractor cost?
Actually, last year at Black Ball, the cost went down for that year.
A lot of it depends on just availability of contractors, and obviously you get more, if there's more availability, you get more competition, you get a little bit better price, and if everybody's busy, then the prices are gonna, you know.
Having been a marine contractor, I can tell you we're doing this job 2 years too late.
Yeah.
2 years ago was a great time to do it. We've been cheap, no one ever hungry.
Is that actually what provide great function, this price seems so crazy, does this actually provide great function, this?
That's a good question, that's part of what we want to do the wave analysis for. We might be able to reduce the length of this, especially depending on the configuration of this. If this extended slightly further out, we might be able to reduce the length of this.
That's the corner that gets the bigger boats in trouble too.
Right here, yeah. So, to answer your question, I think it could be shortened up, but I don't know how much right now. We have to do the analysis.
Are you going to turn it in?
Right.
Stressing toward the south.
It's interesting that the original breakwater actually took another jog back in where the two boats are.
It's strengthened, and it's going to get there.
But we do get northerly storms every now and then where the waves would come straight into the channel and reflect off the south breakwater. Right.
Huh.
They're very, those tend to be the worst. Those are the ones that took out the Hadlock Marina and the ones that just came straight down from the San Juans.
Right.
Speaking of that, did you consider building breakwater?
No.
They were probably putting breakwater in various anchor fields.
We have designed those before. But yeah, this would be a good location for it.
But the dog leg section would be a floating breakwater.
Here, maybe. It depends on what's going on with the sediment, though, that's coming through here. But maybe.
So what's your...
But just to finish that thought, cost-wise, it's probably on the same order of magnitude as well as the other ones. That's what we've seen on other projects.
Do you choose an option that would you recommend?
Well, not really yet. I think, you know, our main task was to kind of narrow down what could be feasible and what the range of cost is. And I think there needs to be a little bit more work at this point to refine exactly this is the preferred type of structure at this location. There's a lot of variables right now that need to be worked through to nail that down and go towards permitting.
Well, Larry, to answer your question on that one is that the agencies are going to have a lot. Let's say I know of three major breakwater projects right now that have all required fish passage. Mm-hmm. And but from the fish passage, you get soil transfer, and we have to do a very good design and friendly persuasion with the agencies because we can't have soil transfer going across the channel, or otherwise it'll be a continual bridging project.
Even though there's no fish passage right now.
Yes. And there's a bunch of them there today when I was down looking at it. Nice, great big jungle.
Well, that's
the salmon sea.
That's the reality. If you stand out on the end of the jetty there, there's fish coming and going all the time. You know, it's, that's the battle to be fought with the agencies.
Do you anticipate giving some consideration to, I mean, we're watering out? How far out before we're building this thing? 2 years?
Well, that's more than a fair question, Pete. Is the basic we have discussed is need to come up with a couple of basic designs that we think the agency will go for. And have to sit down and talk to them and sell what we want. And so one job I've been on here right now, they've been promising the permit since October. And they keep saying, oh, it'll be a few more days, the permitting is being real slow, and if there's that much controversy in it, especially where it involves fish movement, have been extremely slow. So it's really an unknown. The thing is to get started and start working on it and make it as complete as you can so that you have good arguments against whatever they want to argue against.
And what we'll do, as we do with all the projects, once we get something that we can actually show them, we'll have an all-hands meeting up here on site where we get Fish and Wildlife, DNR, Department of Ecology, Corps of Engineers, NIMS, if need be, probably. And so they actually have eyes on the problem. and here's our solution, and kind of, it's a bit of a salesman thing that, hey, we're reducing the footprint, we're doing this, we're protecting, you know, this or that, and...
I'm kind of going at it from the standpoint, you know, you're going to get a pretty keen understanding of the condition of the current structure, and you already have that, it looks like. And so if we had a situation where it was failing, it was unwinding, and it was accelerating due to a storm or something like that, are you anticipating that we can get something on the ground before that happens? And or if it does happen, should we have some sort of a mitigation plan, like to bolt on some whalers and try and get some cabling through that, you know, we could at least hold the thing together long enough to get us?
Well, I think the prudent thing to do is like these gentlemen are saying, is first get in place your kind of intermediate term plan of the replacement, because that process takes a while. But what I'm hearing is, well, what if something happens in the interim? You don't have a permit, you can't get out and do it. Depending on what the circumstances of any failure are, I would imagine the best course of action would be if there's too much time between the time of that occurring and when you can get out and do the replacement, it would be something similar to what they did in 96, driving some piling and, you know, tying it back and trying to fix that localized area as an emergency repair. And permitting wise, you know, it kind of depends on the time of the year, but right. If there's something like that, you can get an emergency permit as long as it's not during the fish migration period.
Especially if we're well into the permitting process, it's easier if there is a catastrophe to go back to the agency and say, hey, you know, we had the storm of the century last night.
So is there any chance that the construction could start in the 2015 fish window?
No.
16.
No.
16.
No way.
16, July 16 is the earliest it will start.
For a project like this, I'd say at the very, very quickest I've ever seen is 12 months, but I'd plan on 18 months from the time of operation.
Allison thinks if we don't change the configuration, we can get a nationwide. And if we can go into the nationwide, we can get 12 months.
Right.
If we start screwing with lengths and widths, we may get stuck in the 18 months to 24 month permitting time.
Right.
We got to be cognizant of that too.
What's nationwide?
Pardon me?
What's nationwide?
It's a special permit that if you don't change any of the parameters, it goes faster. If all of a sudden we say we're going to make this longer because of this, we're going to change this.
Or we'll make it wider.
Then there's more in-depth study we have to do.
So could I ask one more question? Beat a dead horse, but the reason I keep asking about this, you know, you use DC current to protect steel, right? Is that how it's protected?
Yeah,
it's like 12, 40 volts DC, right?
You can use an impressed current system.
And how far away from the breakwater is that current? Do you find that current done? Yeah. So the sheet panel. Is it in the water too?
The reason they ask, are you worried about like fish resources?
No, because we've been battling current in the water at one time to the point even with the marina killed. It still exists. We killed it. That five part, I think, killed all the facility before it left. And it's U shape of the brain of this. There's some very funny stuff going on there. So I was just curious.
I don't think it extends very far away.
No, it's got a different process where the impulse current is into the pile and goes into the pile and down the ground, which it keeps a constant mold. You're looking at an outside source traveling to the piles and then going to ground.
That's what they said about the
marina.
But I'm just curious because we've had a problem.
The only problem you can have with the...
The
problem you can have with the impress is that Washington State Ferries did that at Pier 52. Didn't pay attention to it and almost ate up the piles.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's the other thing.
You have a constant watch on it.
Well, I just wrote out to us and think about it and make sure we don't make that situation work because it's been there. It's been difficult to deal with. So.
The passive system with ANDO doesn't really require very frequent maintenance, and it's, once it's designed and installed, it's reliable.
I'll argue that point with you.
Well, certainly.
Had too much bad experience with it. Theoretically, you're right, but practically, that's not always right.
We actually use that system on the Glacier Spirit, the cathodic system. And you can't detect any current around the boat, even though it's on.
So
falls on.
So,
I was
just going to say, that's pretty much the end of the briefing. We've kind of arbitrarily set our own deadline to try to get into permitting this December. And as such, we're going to have to give Shane some guidance here pretty darn quick so he can start doing his wave analysis and come back and kind of get to that point where we have something we can physically draw up and show the agencies and have our meeting and et cetera. We have submitted the voting infrastructure grant for $1.4 million, which is the max we can ask for. Talked to one of the new directors down at RCO about it, and she thought it was a good project, but it's a she's at the state, and this is a federal grant, you know, so we'll see where that goes. Because of the timing, if we're not successful this year, we can reapply again next year. So we get two bites at that apple. Either way, yeah, if we get the $1.4 million, wonderful. If we don't, we still have to march ahead on this thing. So as far as what you want to do, you want us to put this on the agenda for next meeting, give you a couple of weeks to, and like I said, we'll print out a copy if we can get the digits on this and talk about it some more. And then
why not get it on the agenda as soon as possible?
Yeah, that'd be the next meeting.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I had one question. If you put on some pilots, our pilots, like at 96, would that give you time, breathing time, to make a careful plan? Could you do that, to buy some time to make a...
You know, it could, but unfortunately the cost is almost the same per lineal foot, or it's the same or more than just replacing it. To do it right. So because yeah, if you put piles in there, you want to make sure, you have to make the assumption that you're putting them in there because the existing structure is going to fail and it has to take the 100% of the load. And so it requires a lot of pile.
That was 96 fix.
Right.
Yeah, I'll have to back Sheena on that one. There's not such a thing as a temporary wall. It's exposed to the same elements. And you have to build a temporary repair wall to the same quality standard that you do the final wall.
Right.
And we came back another 2 years from now, and steel is more expensive, labor is more expensive. So,
bringing up the point, if there was a failure, like Pete brought up, you may have to counter that to keep the thing open. My concern, Pete, is on if you have a failure on the south wall, and then you allow that C to go over to the north wall, which is in jeopardy also, it may fail faster because now it doesn't have the loading on it that it would have when it has with the south wall arm.
Okay, so I guess then you're going to go ahead and give us a copy of this, and you can probably go ahead and put a couple of scenarios out that you think might seem feasible. In other words, you had the low one at $3 million. And then just show us what that would be, you know, like Rebel Mound and the north one and so on and so forth. And give us a couple of options, you know, menus of what would be where for us to take a look at.
Steve, if you don't mind me saying so, I think that before you ask him to do that, you guys need to sit down and give him a little bit more guidance in terms of constraints as to exactly what you expect the availability to be. We've talked about this quite a bit during the meeting. You know that at a certain time of year you might be able to start this activity, but you've got to decide whether or not the Wooden Boat Festival is absolutely sacred, and then its schedule must be protected, and you must have full access, and consider what other periods are there as well. I think you need to tell him that before you ask him to come back with options.
So yeah, that's a good point. So what is it you want from us, young fella?
Well, I think what you guys are looking for, I mean, at this point, you know, our main objective was to get an idea of generally what are we dealing with, and that was do the condition assessment. Is it a repair? Is it a rehab? Is it a replacement? So that was the first question we had to answer. But we for replacement, and really our recommendation is you should plan for replacement. There's really not any benefit to doing some sort of rehabilitation.
Do you need to hear from us today on which one we want to pick? I think we could pick today on that. Okay.
I think there's still some work that needs to be done to refine which specific alternative on which location. That needs to happen, and then maybe there's another meeting to go over that at that point, and then a more refined cost estimate at that point too. But there's a menu of various agencies we talked about. There's, you know, some of the things you mentioned. There's a variety of these things that need to kind of get considered to narrow down which specific alternative. But the other main point of this phase was to get an idea of what's the magnitude of cost. Is it $1 million? Is it $4 million? And we feel pretty good about, you know, depending on whichever part of the menu you pick, you're in that $3 to $4.5 million range. And in the next phase, we can tighten that up.
But we can, we can say today we're not repairing it, and we're not rehabilitating the structure that's there. We're replacing the brake wire. I mean, I think everybody's in agreement that that's definitely the direction we're heading here.
And that's an important decision to initiate the permitting work, to do a little bit more engineering work and start the permit, because they want to know what's the scope of the project.
And really, I think we're down to two options. One, either everything using the braced solution, or a combination of the braced on the south and the vertical on the north. And they're both about the same cost from your chart, so it's not going to make a big of a difference.
So there are some things we can do concurrently, and I'll bring back to you next meeting a contract for our permitting person to actually start the biological assessment, which by far, by and large, is the biggest thing that she's going to have to do. It's going to take at least a month. So we can start that now before we figure out what we're going to do and start that process moving.
Is your information to have construction time estimates and our options? I mean, we've got this fish window to work on 2 years from now, in 2016, when construction is going to start. And are your options going to have some sort of estimate on how, and are we going to, because our fish window is drastically reduced, obviously, by other community activities in the marina through the summer. And so my question is, how tight are we going to be on our level of fish window time when we're already behind the eight ball because we can't start until after September?
Right. Well, I think in that next step, we look at that in a little more detail, depending on what the alternative is. But as we were, you know, kicking around earlier, that I think the footprint, well, the nationwide versus individual permit, and how much can we change the footprint is a big, important first decision, because if we have to stay within the existing footprint, then that affects, can you build a new one outside of that and work during the boating season or not? So there's some variables like that that are going to hit.
I'm just asking if your next stage is going to include some.
Yeah.
Some of that. Okay.
So staff, what do you guys at the next meeting, it's going to be on the agenda, but what is going to be on the agenda? What are you hoping for that we're going to vote on? What do you want?
It might be good for us to lay out a little more detail the actual process of the project.
Okay.
You know, maybe come up with a little bit of a timeline, realizing that until you actually get a contractor on board, that contractor, a lot of these guys, you know, they've been doing this for decades and decades, and might have some good ideas on how to save some time or that sort of thing. One of the things that we're thinking of doing, and I guess it's a decision we need to make, not right away, but we have, this project fits the ability to go out for a design build, which is what we did on the new Travelwood Pier, where Shane would get us a certain way in the engineering to where this is the specification, these are the lengths of the sections of the breakwater, this is where it's going to go, etc. And then you hire the contractor, like Orion, who did the, and I'm not saying they would bid on this or not, but they did the travel up here where we turn it over to them. Then their engineer has the freedom to say, okay, we need, you know, 18-inch pile instead of 14-inch. But everything they do, Shane would be our engineer of record, who would then review it and say, yeah, this looks good. And, but it could save a lot of money and push the project a little bit quicker. So
So what's our next step? We need to figure out to get the plans to be able to go to the design bid process, correct? And so that means he's got to come up with something, and that means we have to tell him what to come up with.
Can you, over the next 2 weeks, because our next meeting would be what?
June 11th.
He's got this outlined pretty well.
So there is some data collection that needs to be done for the data collection here would help support these various processes. The need to have an updated survey. The yield grass information is going to be really important to get down to this. They're going to want to know where's the yield grass relative to your proposed work. So I didn't list that on here, but if we don't have a good existing survey, then at some point that needs to get done as well.
We have somebody we can get to do that. Jim Norris can do that for us.
It's that time of year as well. Yeah. It needs to be done in June to early July, typically. And then, as I was talking about, final alternatives evaluation, just a refinement of what that entrance channel, that breakwater configuration is. Is there any benefit to moving things around a little bit and optimizing it? So doing some wave analysis on that, a little more refined analysis on the structural engineering, on all those different concepts to get a better idea of what the geometries of the structures would be and the sizes. All of this helps refine the costs as well, and narrow that range of cost down a little bit. And then after doing that would be some preliminary design work, like a 30 to 35% level design, we would call it. That's typical for developing the permit document. So that gives you some good certainty on the costs and gives certainty to the agencies. This will work, this is what we're permitting, but it still provides some flexibility depending on which direction you go. If you go to the design build route, this is a good foundation for the development of bid documents and gives some flexibility for the design build team to do some refinements. Or if you go the other way, then you just build off of this through a traditional design bid.
So could we, starting with data collection, can we get going on that? Do you need us to be doing, do you need something?
You know, yeah, we'll go ahead with that. Okay. Yeah, we can conduct it with Shane.
I think what I'd like to see is that the port go to the expert and say, Shane, what's your recommendation of the most cost-effective way to do this project? And from that, you say yay or nay. Instead of us saying concrete steel, let's let the expert tell us what he thinks is the most cost-effective way of doing it, and then you can either approve it or not.
Yeah. And I think we would be there at this point right here. We need to do a little bit of this work to be able to have you folks make a final decision on what that's going to look like. And then once you do that, then you launch into the more detailed design work, application.
How long do you need to get to that point? Could you get to there by our second meeting in June?
That'd be tough.
Sensei 30 days?
That'd be tough. Because we need some of the data to do this, especially the eelgrass and the updated survey. That's really important information.
Well, why don't we just get started on this and push as quickly as we can, and we'll just give you an update where we stand at the next meeting or two. And then as soon as you're comfortable with coming back, then if we need to call a special meeting, we can do that again.
And I think that survey work could start right away.
Yeah.
You kind of have an idea of what the alternatives look like, the footprints, and then you just put a circle around the area and get the survey work done.
Okay, we got our march orders. Do I have a motion to adjourn this meeting?
I would love to see the commissioner also ask for a cost performer in terms of where the money would come from, like the bonds would said, maybe you have potential $4 million. Just kind of a general picture. He's kind of about 35% engineering right up front. Just kind of get a cost analysis.
Not today.
Not today. No, yeah. But I mean, as part of this.
Yeah.
Well, we had that meeting with Alan Dashen,
right.
A month and a half or so ago, and we need to revisit all that because, if you remember, we really need to get going on the.
No-brainer
one, which saves us $35,000 right at the top. But once we get this, then we're going to have to engage in the bonding process, which takes some time also. And hopefully we'll get that grant as well, which save a lot, so.
So this concludes Shane's contract with us right now. Remember, we started with a hundred and, I can't remember what that contract was, but it was a lot. And then Shane came back and said, for X, we'll do this. This is deliverable. So we'll come back to you with an amendment to his contract for him to start this next phase of investigation. So we're gonna.
And that's gonna be in the, I'm sorry, go ahead, Brent.
So this cost is 27,000, is that right?
I don't remember what those numbers were.
Something.
14,000?
14,000, okay, I'll start with that.
There's a lot of.
So give us, give us a cost to get us down to that alignment now, so we know that next phase and what we're committing to. That'd be great.
Okay, so we have a motion to adjourn, make a motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.